This is Philip Racy for the Youngstown State University's Oral History Program. And today is January the 6th. Okay. 1983. And I'm talking today with Mr. Fortunato about unionism and specifically about the 1937 Little Steel Strike here in Youngstown. First of all, Mr. Fortunato, could you please give me some background material about yourself, where you grew up and so forth?
I was born and raised in the city of Youngstown. I went to school at East High School. I went to work for Republic Steel Corporation in 1936, and I lived here all my life.
Was your father a steel worker also?
Yes, my dad worked for United States Steel, and my stepdad worked for Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. And my dad worked for Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company, was involved in the 1937 steel strike along with us due to the fact that he was a steel worker and he had to be shut out like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. You attended schools in Youngstown?
Yes.
Which schools did you attend?
I went to Roosevelt School and East High School.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the most often averted questions, I suppose, is why was there a need for a union in the first place?
The way I look at it, that the need for the union was due to the fact that there was people being denied some of their rights and knowledge of doing jobs that they were really qualified to do, and due to the fact that it was a family concern, brothers and sisters and uncles and that would get the better jobs, and the others would take what was left over, labor gang and so on, and would deny the rights of any individual that had a knowledge of doing a job, not a right to do it. And this is the way it come about, that the labor organization come in. And another thing is that the people that belonged to the union and all that wanted to organize the union felt that that was their right to do things that they thought was right and not have it denied, not have them being denied of it.
Someone today, a younger person, would probably say, well, didn't you have seniority rights in those days?
No, Phil, there was no seniority rights. They had a union in there that was called a company union. They had representatives there that if you had any gripes or grievances, you would bring it to them. And it never did materialize in your favor, whichever it may be. They just brought it due to the fact that they worked for the company and they had to take a position. They had to either be with the company or they wasn't, say. So that was another sore eye because of the way things were handled. If I had a grievance, let's say that I went to work, say, this morning, and this job here was a job paying 2 cents an hour higher than this other job. And I knew this job. So I didn't get it due to the fact of the seniority. I had more seniority than the individual that had got the job for that day or two, they said. And I didn't get it. And I went to the representative and I said, well, I think I should have had that job. He said, well, we'll see what we can do about it. And it never did come about, say. So, and that created a little bitterness into the people, you know. Because people running around people, say. And the incident I just gave you there, if you had the knowledge, you didn't have an opportunity to show that you had the knowledge. So when the unions come about and the seniority clause come into the picture, see, it first says that you must be physically fit, able, and have the ability to do the job. This is the way it goes still today. And they don't run people around people due to the fact that you have the seniority. It's that you must have the knowledge and be physically fit and capable of doing the work. They just don't put you in there because they say, Phil, you got 20 years of service, and Fred, you got 5. Phil, you're going to go and do this job, and knowing that you can do it due to the fact that you got the seniority, you're going to take the job and deny this other individual from having it, say. So a lot of that goes on, too. So this has been stopped, you see.
What were the grievance steps under the company union? You went to the representative.
That's all.
And they talked with the supervisor?
They went over and talked to the supervisors, whichever may be. You was never present with the interviews or nothing. And 9 times out of 10, I doubt if they even brought it up to the superintendent. You know, they just throw it away. That's the way I felt, you know. That was my opinion, see? Because there was nothing done.
What about pay issues? For instance, if there was a slowdown, for instance, because of a recession or something, how was internal pay, like pay raises and so forth, how was all that handled?
I don't even remember a pay raise until after they started organizing the union. Mm-hmm. I never did remember a pay raise. I started there in the Republic Steel April 14th, 1936. And I started to work at number 4 Butwell Furnace. I was making $3.76 a day, okay? And the people on the shipping floor were making about $1.50 to $2 a day more. Well, naturally, everybody wanted to get these better jobs. So I went from the furnace floor to the shipping floor. And was fortunate to get the job there, and I went to work there, and I stayed there, and until I retired. So I put 42 years in the Republic Steel, and I stayed there until I retired, and that paid a little better money, you know, and there was better provisions, but there was no raises that I can ever recall until they started going with the steel strike, and then they granted them a 5-cent raise. So that's the only raise I ever remember.
What I was getting at was that some people I've talked to have said that if there was, like, the skill worker, like the engineers or somebody wanted a raise, what they would do is cut the pay of the laborers or somebody else to give them that raise. Is that true, or is that...
I never heard of that, Phil, to tell you the truth. I never heard of that, you know. And
what were the working conditions like prior to the union?
Well, the working conditions were bad, you know. See, when the unions got organized and got into these steel plants, and then with their knowledge and things of how people should be treated is when it come about, they had the workman's compensation at that time, you know. The company pays into it. But when an individual got hurt or anything, well, he would draw a very little amount of monies. And the working conditions was bad too, because they never cleaned up the areas. They didn't just let it go. When you got hurt, you know. See? And they had dispensaries there. And when the unions come in about, then they had the safety programs and everything. And management had to make the place a safe place for an individual to work. See? What the unions believed in is that you, Phil, or Fred, that went to work today for Republic Steel or Sheet and Tube or United States Steel, that you, Phil or Fred, that went into this plant this day with all your limbs and they're all in good working order, this is the way we want you to come back out of that plant, that you have all your limbs and everything in good working order. And if you should be successful to retire, good. And this was one of the main fights that they had, say.
You mentioned that the company's part of the union had medical staff. First of all, how qualified were these people? I mean, did you ever get hurt so you had to go? Maybe I should back up a step. Were you ever injured even slightly so you had to go see any of these people? I mean, I was trying to get at the qualifications.
Yes. They had a good medical staff. They had good doctors. At the time that I was there, the only doctor that I can remember from 1936 until such a time later was Dr. Buchanan. And Dr. Buchanan was a very fine doctor. He was a surgeon and all. They had good medical staff as far as well. They took care of them, you know, up to the best they could, and this is it.
What about workman's compensation? If someone was injured in the plant, what compensation did he or she, get in those days?
I really couldn't tell you, Phil, because I really didn't know how much they would get. I know one thing, it would be very, very small, you know. about $10 or $12. I don't know. To tell you the truth, I just really don't know, you know. So,
if somebody were killed on the job, do you know if there was any compensation to the family?
There was some. The state law stated at that time was, I don't know, there was some compensation, but it isn't as much as it is today, you know. Because then these things would come about and the improvements from organized labor. In other words, a lot of people in this country, even in the city of Youngstown, big business and little business and the small individual, thinks that labor people are a bunch of hoodlums and labor people are radicals. And it's, no, this is not so. The labor people are well-educated and sophisticated the same as anybody else. Only thing is that we're bringing to the public and all the knowledge to let them know the things that are going on that shouldn't go on, that they should be treated the same as everybody else, and they want their fair share of a product or whichever it may be. So.
How did you get your first job in the mill? Was your father responsible for that? Or?
No, I had to go down to the Republic myself, you know. They used to have a lot of that, you know, that the uncles would refer them to the employment office and they would get jobs and cousins and so on and so forth. It was like a clique, you know. And you go down and you'd lie, you know what I mean, and you went across while you got the job, say, or something, and the guy just liked the way you talked and things like that there. But I'll never forget the day that I went to get the job, say. I was talking about it last night up at the church with a couple of individuals. I had a meeting in there, Sam Papino and them. We were talking about old times, you know, and it come about how we got jobs and how they got jobs and everything else, see. So I went down to Republic Steel on April the 13th and applied for a job. And at that time, the employment manager, his name was Mr. Rose. And he was, to my opinion, a good guy, but then on the other side, you know how a young fella is. He's just an old crab, see. So looked me out through the window and says, "What do you want?" I said, "I want a job, Mr. Rose." He says, "Look like you're too small for a job." I said, "You don't have a job in a Republic Steel that can kill me or hurt me." I said, "I can do any job this mill's got." And I'll never forget his remark. His answer was, "You're one of them cocky little kids, ain't you?" I said, "No." I said, "I'm just telling you the truth. I'm just one of them rough and tough kids." He says, "You got yourself a job." And told him he'd go to get examined and all. And they said, "You go to work tomorrow night," or that same night, say the 13th. So on 11 to 7, it would go for the 14th, say. So I actually went there on 11 to 7, and on the night of the 13th, that went for the 14th. I went to work. I put a bad night, but I survived. I thank the good Lord that I put 42 years in there and retired with 42 years of service.
So when the 1937 strike started, you had been there about approximately a year, or?
Yes, uh-huh. Just about a year.
What was the reason for the strike? Why did the people go out on strike?
Well, we wanted to have the union as a bargaining agent for us, you know. And this is why we wanted organized labor, and management resented it, and then the steel strike came about, so that's it.
And what local did you belong to at that
time? I belonged to 1331, down on Poland Avenue. Mm-hmm.
And you were rank and file, you were not an officer?
No, no, I was rank and file, yes. I was a member, dues-paying member.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned the individual seems to be most responsible as far as management, I suppose, would be Tom Girdler. He was then.
Yeah, he was the chairman of the board. Yeah. He said went, you know, the chairman of the board, he has all the say.
Yeah. You related a remark that he made about before there would be a union. Could you elaborate on that? Could you tell me what he said?
What he said, what Tom Carney says, that he believed in, that before he would sign a labor agreement with a labor organization, that he would go back out on the farm and plant potatoes. So then we took that up from there and made the slogan that let's send Tom Girdler back to the farm. And this is what happened. We sent him back to the farm.
How did you first learn about the strike? Was there a mass meeting or something?
No, we were organizing on QT basis, getting people to sign cards and things like this, and then we presented them to the company. The union presented it to the company and says that they wish to have this, the CIO as their bargaining agency. And the company resented this, and this is the way the strike come about. They set a date, I forget just what date it was that they went on strike, but they had set a date through the bargaining and this and that and everything else, and they says that as of this date, they didn't give us a recognition of a contract, then we would have a right to go on strike, so this is what we did. They wouldn't do it. Then they had their people in there where the company union come back in again and start to play a big role, see. They was going from department to department and telling them, now don't go in there tonight and vote for that strike because you're going to be losing your jobs, see. And this is another thing that the people resented in the plant at that time. So they said, no, we wasn't going to do that. So they turned around and went against their word and went out. And it started on the steel strike, if I can recall real well. It started on the afternoon shift. And I happened to be working the afternoon shift. Seemed like everything falls when I was working. Happened to fall on the afternoon shift, and it was myself, Joe Seminaro, and a few others that were on the afternoon turn. And we went out, and that's from that day on, we was closed out. So. And this is the way the steel strike come, and we had set up picket lines and allowed nobody to go into the plant. But naturally, you'd have people sneaking in, and they'd do anything they wanted to do to get it back into the plant to go to work. But my understanding was that the company had a lot of supplies in there, food supplies, they had cots, and they had everything for the scab that wanted to work. To have work, they had a place for them to sleep, and they had some places to eat, and all this. But as far as change of clothes, I don't know. And they weren't successful too much in doing that. But they did keep some of the foremen stayed in, and some labor people stayed in there too, you know, because the ones that were caught in there stayed in there. They didn't want to come back up. And so a lot of them had the fear that they were going to do them harm, but we weren't going to harm nobody. Our theory and philosophy was for the 1937 steel strike, don't create no violence. Back up. If any violence occurs, let them do it, see, not us. And this is the way it come about. Then the riot started to come about. Before the riot came, I was on the afternoon turn on stop 5 Poland Avenue, and we got a telephone call that the scabs were down at Rosenbaum's store buying uniforms to go in the plant.
Where was Rosenbaum's store?
Rosenbaum's store was right under the corner. The third store up from Basin Street and East Federal. It's not there anymore, no.
Now, who called you? Do you recall?
I don't know. Somebody got a call down at stop 5 and says, the scabs are down at Rosenbaum's store getting uniforms to go into the plant. So four or five of us got in the car, and we went down to Rosenbaum's store to interview, see what was going on. And I recall telling the men, I said, now look, no violence, just don't get angry. Let's go in and see what it's all about, and then we can talk. Don't start no problems. So they all agreed. We walked into the store, and right away they seen us, and I asked one of the individuals, what are you doing here? And talked back and forth, then we went outside. And we told him, I says, what are you going in there buying? Are you getting a uniform so you can go and scab in the Republic? No. They were saying they were going to be deputized as deputies. So we marched them up Federal Street. Marched them up Federal Street and...
Okay, maybe I should back you up a second.
Go ahead.
When you say you marched them up Federal Street...
We walked them up Federal Street.
Do you kind of friendly persuade them to go, or do they come voluntarily, or...
Well, when they seen there was four or five of us, you know, yeah. And then some more come about, you know. Well, Nancy, the best thing for them to do was to leave or, you know, or fight, but we wasn't going to fight. If they threw the first punch, then we would punch back to defend ourselves, see? That's what I told
them. So they just left with you then?
They just left with us, and we turned around and had a, and walked them up the street, and that was it.
I didn't mean to interrupt your...
No.
You were going to Market Street.
And on the way coming back to Basin Street to get my car, there was a little scuffle, you know. We had a little scuffle, bumped shoulders and stuff like this here, and a couple of punches were thrown, you know, that I understand. But I didn't throw no punches. So coming back down to get to my car, the sheriff's red cattle truck, I called it the cattle truck, it was a red big pickup truck, was parked there. And one of the deputies says, "He's one of them, grab him." So he threw me in that truck. Threw me in that truck, and a car coming in between the truck and the street, the traffic, so they weren't going to let me go to jail, see? And who they were, I just couldn't recall right now.
Were these regular police? These were regular police.
They were deputy sheriffs.
The deputy sheriffs, yes. But
yeah.
they arbitrarily just decided that since you were involved with the strike that you were going to go to jail.
Yeah, something like this, sir. They didn't. So anyway, they throwed me in there and brought me, took me to jail. And this truck was going to stop them from taking me to jail, see? And naturally, when violence comes, why the sheriff says, they don't move, just shoot them down, you know. So, let's not have this, you know.
Was Elsner, I think that...
Sheriff Elsner was the sheriff at the time.
Was he the one that he was saying this? I mean, that was just an order that somebody
was given. I don't know whether the sheriff said it or not, you know, but that was just an order. But anyways, I went to jail. I stayed there 3 days. And they left me out.
Now, this was before the night of the shooting?
This was before the night of the shooting. This all leads over to the night of the shooting. Then, anyways, after I got out after 3 days, I had to go to Squire Martin's court to get released, and we had attorneys and all, you know, to defend us. And this is when Force Cavalier, the honorable judge, okay, he was our attorney, my attorney, for the labor organization. He was just coming up, and this is when he really made a name for himself, and it was wonderful. Hey, Cavalier is a smart man. I had a lot of respect for him, you know. So we come out, and the day of the riot at Stop 5, the big fight at Stop 5, the day of that riot, it was Ladies' Day on a picket line. We'd done things real nice and the way it's supposed to be done. No violence and stuff and raising all kinds of cane. We wanted to do things in a good, ordinary fashion, okay? So we had ladies there at the picket line. And they came down, and there was no problem. They just come down, they sang songs, and they marched up and down with their husbands and everything else, you know? And I happened to be home. Well, I don't know what I went home for, but I went home for something. And I got a call, and they said, there's trouble at Stop 5. And I used to live on the east side of Youngstown. I'm coming down over Center Street Bridge, and my eyes were starting to water. I said, boy, that there smells awful. You know, and getting around about dusk, say. So here, we couldn't get down Poland Avenue, so we had to go all the way on around and come on down the hill. And I'm asking people what happened. They said that one of the women said something, and one of the policemen resented it and pushed it. See? And she resented it and slapped him, you know. So, hey, what? You have no right to hit me, you know. And I'm going to hit you because I'm going to defend myself, right? So this is what she did. She defended herself. And I guess he must resent it. And that's where the fight started. Then they say that they had all the police running underneath into the tunnel of Stop 5, into the plant for protection. So that's when the fight started. It started there. So in order to block traffic of anybody getting hurt on pulling that. They turned a bus around crosswise in the street.
When you say they, the union turned?
No, people. I don't know whether they were all pickets or what,
yeah.
But they turned it over. They just pushed it crosswise, didn't damage it. Upset the cruiser car across, you know, the street. In other words, to save innocent individuals from getting hurt in case anything did happen. So it got to be around about evening time, and they started shooting, and I was up on Powersdale Hill, and this is where we were at.
So they weren't shooting when you first got there?
No, tear gas later on, right. And they resented it, so then naturally some of the strikers must have went home and got some of their ammunition too, you know. So we did find out that in the Republic Steel, whether they were city policemen, or whether they were Republic Steel policemen. But in all the cases and everything that came about, that Republic Steel had high-powered rifles in there. And they was at, they would be shooting from the building facing Poland Avenue. That would be the shipping department building. And the first crane there would be number one crane, and they'd get up on top there, and had they got an opening, the sheet iron opened up, and they could see right out there. And every time they shot a flare, they shot one picket. One of them was Upper Jessic, and the other one I just can't recall what his name is. I just forget it. But anyways, one individual got hit right by the Mike Evans' gas station. He was there. And this other individual was behind like a tank on the Sahaja gas station across the street. Knelt down there. And every time they shot a flare, they got one of these guys. And this individual was by that tank. There was no way that he could have got hit in the dark, unless it was light. And he got hit right by that tank. And there was a few other individuals that got some shotgun pellets, you know, and that took them to the hospital. But that was the only violence we had.
Okay, you were telling me that you were driving your car. How did you get out of your car? I mean, from what you're saying, some of that, you had to see some of that outside of your car, or did you park it someplace?
Oh, yeah, I parked my car on Alexander and Powers Way and walked down to Poland Avenue. You know, while coming down to Poland Avenue. And you couldn't get too far down to Poland Avenue because there was a lot of stuff there. But I seen the cruiser car there, and I seen the bus over there, and it was in good shape when we seen it. And the only thing we could figure out is the way the automobile got burnt, that there had to be a shot of a flare had to be shot into that car. That's the only way. And they proven that there was holes in the car.
Okay.
They wanted to blame it on the pickets, you know, but we didn't do it.
when you got out of your car, there were people fleeing up past.
Oh, yes, they were running all over the place. Oh, just like. They were just like cattle that know where to go, you know, because you're out in the open, and they're undercover, and they're shooting at you, you didn't have no chance. So they was running all over the place, getting away and stuff. And then were the two individuals that really got, you know, they got killed, and that was it. But the others, there was some that got hurt, but not that bad.
As you were going down, besides these people running, what do you remember taking place around you at that particular time?
Phil, the only thing I remember at that time, I was just as scared as the others were, you know. And I was trying to tell them not to get excited, you know, just keep calm and let's move back, you know. Let's move back away from the thing and come on to get it in the shelter somewhere where we don't get hit. But don't panic and run out there, you know. And that's what we were trying to do, is to try to get them to get off of Poland Avenue. And we did. We got them off of Poland Avenue, all right. Then they were up on Powersdale Hill, see. And trying to get behind these little buildings that had houses there and everything else, trying to get behind there to see what's going on until it's cleared up, say.
But you and your fellow unionists were trying to just basically get people reassembled so they wouldn't be injuring
each other.
What, besides Howard-powered rifles, did you hear any kind of other weapons other than single shot?
No, that's all. They were all single shots, and there was a lot of it. And it sounded just like a 4th of July. Yeah, and that's That's it, there, right there. See?
Okay, so you, your basic effort was basically to just, after that, to get people up there. Did you go back down? Was there any reason why you would have gone back down, and did you see anything else there?
Oh, yeah. Naturally, I was curious as everybody else. I wanted to see what damage was done and stuff. But then I was very careful going down because I didn't trust anything. And as I was going down, I'd get alongside of one of the buildings and stay there, and I got alongside of Mike Evans' gas station. So. And all I could see right there was the cruiser car and the bus, nothing else on the street. Everything was all right, see. And it got sort of quieter in the morning. Then the next day and stuff, continued to do as we were doing, you know. But the policeman had no right to hit this woman or slap her or whatever we had done. And if he was a man and he would have ignored the remark. Say that remark was made, okay? I don't know all of us. Say a remark was made. If you as an individual would have ignored it, there would be no problem. But it didn't, say. In other words, I honestly think that they agitated it so that trouble could occur and work in the management's favor so they try to destroy us another way, say. This is the thing that I believed in.
So you think it was basically just to discredit the whole strike?
Right. This is what I honestly believe. That's what had happened, and these people wouldn't have got hurt. And there was money made. I don't know who made the money, but somebody made the money for doing all this here, because it was the city police that done this. See. Trying to remember his name. I forget. I just can't remember the guy, the policeman's name that was in charge of the police at that time down there at Poland Avenue. See, what they had, like captains of the police force would come down and they'd be in charge of the crews, you know. That's it. But as far as the steel strike was concerned, labor did not instigate the strike in any way, shape, or form. And it was done that way. And I honestly believe that it was agitated from outside. So the unions would not have an opportunity to organize and hurt them within some other way. But they were successful and they got where they're at today. But the thing is, I honestly believe in labor organizations, and they've got to have labor organizations. I firmly believe that management, labor, and federal government, the three big powers of the country, they control, okay? That they can sit down like individuals and negotiate problems and solve them without having any hard feelings, and give and work together as a team. Preach what you're saying, but practice it, see? And you'll have a lot better place to live, a lot better place to work in. Conditions that are existent today in this country in labor organizations and in management are created by management, not by labor, by management. Labor never has enough money to carry them over, never, because of the waiting period that eats you up. They're making money today, yes, I grant you, they're making money. But it's so is management making the money. If management wasn't making a profit, they would close the door. That's the same as you running a grocery store. If you have the same five cans of beans on the shelf today, Phil, and you have the same five cans of beans on the shelf tomorrow, and you're not moving one, you're going to close it, right? It's like the same identical thing with them. They go around and they preach. This is management's preaching. They go around and preach that we want to get along with labor. We want to get along with our people that work for us, because they're the backbone of the company, all right? But it isn't so. It isn't so. Even when I worked down there, when I worked in the plant, the foremen were forbidden to associate with the men on the outside. If you were a foreman and you and I were good friends, I couldn't come to see you no more. I have to come and see you on a QT basis. And they talk about, you talk about communism. I can't understand it, Phil, believe me. You say, yes, we're going to do this. we're going to do it, but we don't practice it. Then they want labor to give all the same. Labor, labor, labor. Labor's been given and bending over backwards. Labor and the unions want this country to operate and operate good because they think there's no other country in the world like this one, believe me. And we have an interest in it. But we don't want to be cut short.
Just to kind of clarify a couple of points, I back you up to the strike. From the time that you were on Center Street Bridge and drove around to Poland Avenue, I believe you said, approximately how long did that take you?
Well, about 15 minutes, Phil, something like that, because you come up the Center Street, and you couldn't come down Poland Avenue, so right then, right there was a side street. You come right on down that side street, and you came out on in, see, to stop 5. It wouldn't take too long, about 15 minutes.
Did you... you didn't see the original origin of the
No, I didn't see how the fight started or anything, you know. I didn't see that. But I only saying what I was told.
But what what did you see when you were talking about you had gone behind the gas station? Were there people from the, well, I won't say the union because I don't know who these people were, but were there still people on the opposite the mill when you came down behind the gas station?
No, there was nobody on Poland Avenue at the time, nobody. Uh-huh. When I came on back down again, and everybody moved up the street, and management was the ones that was on the opposite side that was doing the shooting, management side, it was on management side, and we were on their side, okay? That would be the south side, and the other one would be the north side. And we were on this side. And when I got down to the gas station where I told you after the shooting was done and all, to see what was happening, if there was anything else, there was nobody on the street, see. And all the shots had came from the mill side, because there was nobody on the street trying to shoot this way.
When you say there was nobody on the street shooting this, you mean towards the mill?
Towards the mill or towards, or from the mill toward us on the street. It came up from high, that's all.
Okay. Did the shooting, after most of the people were evacuated to or ran to the higher ground, did the shooting continue for a long time after that?
Well, I'd say it did for about 10 or 15 minutes, Phil, at the most, you know what I mean? Exaggerating because time, you know, when something like that there happens, you forget it's a long time, you know? But I don't think it lasted too long because after the two individuals got hit, you know, one got hit one time and another one got hit after that, see? A little later on, like I stated that every time a flare went off, one of the individuals got hit, see? And that's when it would come about, so naturally, you get mad and you start shooting back or whatever you're doing, you know, who was doing it, I don't know, because I didn't actually see it.
I mean, did the people that you saw shooting where the union people had been, were there a lot of those people? I mean, at first I'm assuming there were people there shooting somewhat at towards the mill on occasion.
I think so, yeah.
But were there a lot of people down there? I mean, a dozen?
Well, there was. Right where Apogesic got hit, there was about 4 or 5 individuals there.
The gas station.
Yeah. And that's Mike Evans' gas station. Then across the street was the Sahaya gas station on the Poland Avenue side. And there was a tank on this corner. There was about 5 or 6 over there too, see. And they were out in the open the same way. And how these guys got hit is a mystery because when they shot that flare off, one of them got it, you know. This one got it, then this other individual from Camel, I forget what his name is, but he got hit, see, that was that.
Was that Bogovich or something like that?
I guess so. I just can't recall what his name was,
Well, I mean, I don't want to tell you because I wasn't there.
Uh-huh.
During the course of that strike, even prior to the events that took place in June 19th. What was the general means of telling everybody what was going on during the strike? How did you get everybody together and tell them what was going on? Or did they all congregate to one place?
They all congregated there, where they had to pick a line and stop five, and then there was people down there at the Center Street Bridge, you know. And naturally, the word of mouth, when you're on strike, the word of mouth gets around, and then curiosity, people came down to see what it was, you know, and how the strike was progressing along. But there was nobody there to agitate or heckle or hecklers, nobody. Everything was running in a nice, peaceful manner, you know.
One of the people that I talked to mentioned that usually about 6 o'clock or so people would gather, and there was some kind of platform across from the tunnel away from one.
Yes, right.
Do you know who some of the speakers were? And did you hear any of them?
Yes. There was one there by the name of Chappie. He was he was an organizer for the union, and he used to come in and give talks about labor, you know, the things that we should do and why and things like this here. And to do things in a peaceful manner, you know. Don't agitate or aggravate nobody. If they're going to aggravate you, just ignore it. See? To keep it peaceful. And he says that we'll win this strike. See? And there was a few others that came down and talked. See, the United Mine Workers of America, John L. Lewis, financed the steelworkers' strike. Helped them. They gave us $1 million to get it going. And I figured between Phil Murray and John L. Lewis, they were real close friends, you know. So then this is when Phil Murray took over the labor organization in 1937, see, when they had this getting it started. And he even loaned the United Steelworkers organizers to organize the union and people to understand the new the labor movement, see, that they, because the United Mine Workers was there all the time and they were together, so the only way to do it, you have well-qualified people to do the job. And this is what happened. Then they knew what to do. And we followed their instructions, and they come down and they talked to us and told us, by all means, every meeting they had, we had, and before, when it ended, they stated that by all means, no violence. And this is what we done. See.
Did John L. Lewis himself ever come in here?
No. Oh, Phil Murray came in Youngstown, and Chappie, and then they had a few others. Then John Mayle was the district director. He was in town. And it was, that's all, see. And Uys Casella was a staff man, and he was in the union hall down on Fulton Avenue. And then we took care of the pickets, you know, the best way we could. We formed the soup kitchen and things like that and fed them.
Where was that located at?
That was located at the Romanian Hall on Fulton Avenue. That was down by Gibson Street and Fulton Avenue. That old Romanian Hall over there, it's not there anymore now, you know. And that was the place there. But we made sure that nobody went hungry.
Who was responsible for operating the soup kitchen? The union, you mentioned.
It wasn't a soup kitchen, it was just a phrase. But we had food, we was giving food out, you know. Mm-hmm. And to the pickets, to the strikers that was out on strike, they would give them food. So they could, you know, feed their families.
one of the places that seems to be linked to the labor organizations, or as has been mentioned quite a bit, was Central Auditorium. Did you attend any meetings?
Yes.
There? Mm-hmm. Do you recall what the purpose of the meeting was?
The purpose of the meetings at labor held is to inform the membership, the people, of what's transpiring and how the union was progressing in negotiations with the companies, see. And they would hold these meetings and inform us, and this is the way we know what's going on and how things were going. And the people were well informed. And every time they got done with a meeting, they always stressed no violence, see. And this thing's stuck in the people's minds that have no violence and we're going to have a peaceful strike. And this was it. So when this fight occurred, is just repeating myself, when the fight occurred, that's what happens. Everybody's going to protect themselves, see.
What did Phil Murray look like?
He was a big fella. Yeah, I'd say about 6 foot or better, you know. But he was a well-educated man and well-versed on labor organizations and things that people needed. And Phil was an individual that didn't believe in no violence either, say. And he believed that you could do better by talking across the table and negotiate and get things done.
Was he a younger man or was he an older person?
Well, he was younger because I remember Phil Murray. I attended a couple of conventions and I remember Phil Murray at that time, gray hair and well thought of. Oh, I'd say that Phil Murray was in his early 50s or something like that, or much earlier than that, you know. Because I think when Phil passed on, he was in close to 70, something like that there.
I understand that the, I think it was Republic, used to operate a recruitment station on Public Square, with the Dollar Bank building is now. Maybe it's the wrong company, but I thought during the strike there was a, that the company was trying to recruit workers to go back to work even while the strike was on. Is that information correct or?
To the best of my knowledge, Phil, I really don't know, to tell you the truth. And if it was, I forgot about it, you know. It's been so long. There's a lot of the things that you do remember and there's a lot of them that you don't remember, see. Like the incidents of the riot and the fight that we had at the Rosenbaum store, that sort of stays with you all the time, you know, because you was into it, say. And but as far as the recruiting the people to go back to work and things like this, I've heard some remarks made about it, but I wouldn't verify it, you know.
there was mention that sometime during the day, the 19th, when the incident occurred, that there was an incident with a truck that was trying to get in that had supposedly had tear gas and other materials on it. Do you know anything about that?
The only thing that I remember there, Phil, is that they did say that a truck came down and stopped fire, pulled an ambulance to try to get into the plant. And whether it was a truck, what the truck had was a closed van truck. The truck was closed and nobody could see what was in it. And the pickets stopped the truck from going into the plant, say. And they felt that there was food going in there, whichever it may be, because they figured that it was time that them fellas in there didn't have any more food, you know. It'd do one or two things, either come out or starve, we'll put it that way, okay? So that's the only thing I can remember. But the truck driver didn't give him no arguments or anything else. He just backed the truck on up and away he went. That's it. There were no arguments there, say.
Was the truck, when you say closed truck, did it look like a moving van, those kind of
things? Yeah, something like that there.
How did the company recruit their police as far as, you know, for security and so forth?
Well, they had their own police department, you know. They had their own police department, and that's, they had everybody, all the police that were available to come back into the plant and stay there. So that was it, that was to protect the plant.
Was there an organization that management had, either from the company or from, you know, nationally, that recruited scabs? In other words, where did they get these scabs? Were they local people or did they bring them in from?
Oh, local people, like the individual that worked there, you know, and stuff, and they would try to get them to go to the plant, things like that. Sure, that's the only thing I can I know of. But as far as bringing in outsiders, I never seen any outsiders come in, you know. I never heard of any outsiders, but that was the only thing. That's the individuals who wanted to go back to work and protect their rights and jobs and things like this. After 2 weeks or a week or so, no money coming in, and the individual's going to have to do one or two things. And he's married and has obligations, so he figured he's going to try to go into the plant, say. So when he would get down there, they need to find a lot of pickets, and he would change his mind and go back home, you know. And then you get some stubborn ones that don't want to, then they hurt themselves, you know. But of all the problems and the trouble that occurred, labor did not start it. And I'm sure that, as I am sitting right here, no, labor didn't start it.
When the strike took place, did the company just lock the gates, or were scabs or people who were trying to break the strike allowed to come and go? Or, I mean, you mentioned people would not go in because of the picket line and so forth, but did the company actually physically just, you know, like either close the tunnel or whatever, or were they open so that people could come in if they wanted to?
No, the tunnel was closed, you know. On Portland Avenue and Stop 5, the tunnel is where the railroad track goes across, and that's why it's called, it's a tunnel. That was the main gate for the people who worked in the Stop 5 area. Then they had a gate up there on Center Street that would come down off the steps, and they would come in through there. So we had pickets at both ends of Center Street Bridge, on both ends, the south side and the north side of the bridge, plus having people on the bridge by the steps when the bridges want to try to go down, they would stop them there. And then they had another entrance at Stop 5, and the pickets were at Stop 5. Nobody would get through that gate. And then they would try to come in through Cedar Street, walk the tracks all the way on down to the plant, go through the JoJo's scrapyard at that time, say, and try to go in through that way. And there were individuals that would try to come in from off the east side, walk over the New York Central tracks and come right on down across the B&O tracks and into the Republic Steel, say. So we had the area covered off pretty good so they couldn't get in there at the plant, say. And we'd explain to them what was happening. If you're going in there, you're going to defeat the purpose that we believe in, say. And this is what would happen. But there was never a picket or anybody that would try to get into the plant that was abused. I know this for sure, because we made sure that everybody that was on the line that would obey the law, the rules and regulations that we set down.
So basically whoever was on the picket line would just ask them not to go in, but they wouldn't stop them from, if they could get into the plant.
It's true, because naturally, you take, like you and I, we're going to go into that plant, and we see about 10 or 12 people out there. Well, you and I are not going to go through that plant, you know. Because then if we got stubborn and said, well, we're going to go through that, and we start throwing punches. Well, naturally, the picket, he's not going to get hit. If he gets hit once or twice, he's going to hit you back.
Right.
He's going to protect himself, see. And this is what we did. We didn't do it. We made sure that they threw the first punch. Then we weren't responsible after that, because it's human nature, you know.
Some people have said, and it wasn't said of that particular spot, location, that there were some communists involved in the strike. To your knowledge, were there any communists involved in the strike?
Well, truthfully speaking, I really couldn't say yes, and I couldn't say no, you know. But some of the knowledge that I have of labor organizations and how they come about, naturally the radical organizations like communists and socialists and Trotskyites, this is when they work the best, when there's a lot of interruptions, say. And if there were communists there, they sure didn't create no problems, say.
How most of the top union people were either Irish or English or somewhere in that persuasion. How did they communicate with the the mass, the people who were either Italian or Slovak or whatever, you know, when they had these rallies, how did they get, did they have translators for the speakers, or did, was there a group in the union who were bilingual that translated all this? How was the information gotten from?
The people were, everybody that was there from the foreign element, you know, knew what the individual was talking about. You know, he had some knowledge, and the individuals that came in and talked, they didn't use these big, long, 10-cent words. They talked ordinary labor talk, because they're speaking to people that are labor people and doesn't have the high, they're not highly educated the same as everybody else. And they will speak to them in the language they knew. And we had Italians there, we had Polish people there, Slovaks and all, from the top group that could speak, and they were talking, you know, and they would speak in English. And the majority of the people understood what they were talking about, so.
The reason I asked that was that I was given to understand that a lot of the mills were specifically one ethnic group or another. Like if you were of one ethnic background, that you would work in certain areas of the mills. Is that information correct? For instance, if you were Italian, did you work in certain mills in different plants?
No, they had all nationalities working all over, you know, in every department.
As but I mean, as departmentally, were they basically on the...
When they would promote an individual, then they would be promoted, like I stated before, that it was selected people, like nephews and uncles and cousins to the foreman or this general foreman. These individuals would get good jobs, and let's put it this way, that the foreign element or the hunky, that they would classify them at that time, were hunkies, but we're all hunkies as far as that goes, you know. They would get what was left over, say. And I still can remember to this day, okay, that after the strike was over, you know, and I went to work back to work again. I didn't go back to work until February the 13th, 1940. I was locked out from 1937 until 1940. And my case, I was one of the individuals that the company did not want, okay, back. And between negotiations and between lawsuits and court rulings, why the company had to put me back to work. On April the 18th, 1938, the Third Circuit Courts of Appeal, I think it was the Third Circuit Courts of Appeal or the Seventh Circuit Courts of Appeal, rendered a decision against the Republic Steel Corporation and all the steel and all the little steel strike people to call all the individuals back to work with top seniority, with their seniority back. So Republic called individuals back, but it didn't call me back. They still held me out. See? So then when I got back to work again is when the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the decision of the Circuit Courts of Appeal and says that they must call all of them back and reinstate them and give them their seniority and must pay them back monies from the time that they were out. The union wanted them to get back money from 1937, and through negotiations and all and rendering different decisions, then they had come to an agreement that anybody that got called back to work after October 18, 1938, would be eligible for back monies, okay? So I happen to be one of the individuals that got back to work on February the 13th, 1940, 3 years. And all the monies that I was entitled to was just about close to 18 months. But I went back to work with my full seniority and have no discrimination against me any way, shape, or form. And that I would be recognized the same as I was when I first got hired into the plant. That was that decision.
Mm-hmm. most of the people that were singled out were either union leaders or activists of some sort. Why didn't they want you to come back?
Well, they figured that I was one of the union agitators or something, you know. Yeah. They didn't want back was organizers and people that were affiliated with the labor organization too strong. See, figuring that they could, if they kept these individuals out, then they could weaken the chain, see. But with the rulings that was rendered in our favor, and we got back to work. And even after I got back, the plant still was bitter toward its people, you know.
3 years later.
Yes, they were still bitter toward its people. They wasn't that good relationship, you know. They just showed that there was a relationship, you know. But they still had that hate that, hey, Fred Fortunato's an agitator, or John Brown's an agitator, or Jimmy is there as an agitator. You watch these guys. If you can get anything on them, you know, go ahead. But they fail to realize the fact is that if they was going to fire me or discipline me, they would have to have a just cause and bring it in the front of an arbitrator, and between the labor organization and the arbitrator and the attorneys on both sides, they would have to show a real just cause to get rid of me, see. And they wouldn't do it, see, because if they knew that what they were waiting for, that Fred Fortunato to make a mistake, see, a big mistake that was going to hurt the company or something, then they have a right to knock me out, see. But naturally, Fred Fortunato had to be on his toes, and the rest of these individuals had to be on their toes at all times, see, until such a time why they lifted it, and you can go ahead and do your job the way you want it. But you were watched and watched close there. Nobody telling you no different. These are facts. They were watching you pretty close, and the company would deny some of this, you know. But I remember going back to work after 1938 or 1940. I went to work 21 turns a week to try to get a day. That was 7 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 11 to 7 at night. Okay? And the foreman would come out and say, we would all sit on a bench over there, you know. You and you go to work. You and you go to work. You and you go to work. And you go to work. The rest of you just come back in the afternoon. I ain't got nothing for you. Hand-picked people. These individuals were working 5 days a week. I myself and a few other individuals haven't made a turn yet. See. And this is the beauty part. And these are facts. There was myself and three other individuals haven't worked a week, haven't worked a day that week, okay? So it comes on a Saturday. Well, naturally, you know, you're all single and you're young, so you figure, well, we haven't worked a turn yet, so let's not go out Saturday night. We'll go out and have some fun, have a drink or two, and go out and have some fun. So this is what we did. But Sunday morning came, we went back to the plant to go to work. Right off the bat, the foreman comes up, where were you last night? I could have used you. Where were you last night? You know, the ones that wasn't there.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't worked all week, so we decided that we were going to stay home, you know. Said, I ain't got nothing for you today. So we come back again, nothing. Same way. Oh, Monday morning. Well, we were pretty heft up then. We haven't worked, and these other individuals will make it 5 days. See. These are some of the things that the public don't know that these companies used to do, say. So Monday morning come, we had a little caucus among ourselves. If we don't go to work today, we're going to find out something. So we turned around and we went out there Monday morning. The foreman says, put everybody to work. He says, all you guys there got a week off because you didn't come out to work. Well, naturally, we got pretty heft up and we knew what we was going to do. So we told the foreman, so how could you, and I asked him, how could you give me a week off and I haven't even worked a day yet? He said, you got a week off. I said, now you answer the question, how can I get a week off and I haven't worked a day? He said, I'll answer your question. I said, okay. Where you went? So us, then the other individuals and myself, went down and seen the superintendent. walked in his office and we're storming pretty goddamn mad, you know. After all, I'm entitled to the same amount of work as this other individual. If you've got 3 days' work, give it to me and give me three and give him three or give me two, give me something. So we walked in and seen the superintendent. Our superintendent at that time was Al. His name was Allen. Allen was his name. And his other buddy was the head shipper of the shipping department of shipping and Gordon's was Lawrence Hoskins, okay? So Hoskins says to me, he says, what do you want for it? I said, I want to see Mr. Thompson. And he was sitting in his desk over there, you know? And he said, what do you want to see me about? I says, we want to know one thing, Mr. Thompson. I says, how can an individual get a week off and then work a day? Surprised, you know, shocked. He said, what do you mean? I said, just what I said, Mr. Thompson. I says, us individuals right here. I said, and the other ones, the other two didn't want to come in.
Yeah.
I said, but us three haven't worked a day or a week, and the foreman gives us a week off. He said, now, wait a minute. He couldn't believe this. So Mr. Hoskins says, now, this can't be true. I said, yeah, it is true. I said, now, why should I lie to you? I says, I asked him that. And he asked all three other ones, Jimmy and Chuck. So he said, no, this can't be done. I said, this is what happened. I says, we went out 7 to 3 in the morning, 3 to 11, 11 to 7. We went all week, didn't work, so Saturday night we decided that we was going to go out and have a couple of drinks and have some fun. I said, we're young, no problem in that, is there? He says, no. I said, we didn't come out, but we came back out to work Sunday morning, and the foreman says, I could have used you last night, but you wasn't here. He said, I'll tell you what you do. You go to work right now. He said, I'll call the boss and tell him to put you to work. So we did. We went back down into the shanty down there, and he had called him, I guess. He says, what you guys go down and see the superintendent for? Hey, that's the only place I can go. I said, you told me that I got a week off, and I asked you how come, and you tell me you don't have to answer the question. I said, so I have to get an answer. So I went to the superintendent, and he gave me the answer, and he said, it isn't right. I said, so therefore, you was playing pussyfoot with your friends.
Yeah.
I says, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to make a living. So this is what happened. And even after the story, see, Phil, everybody figures that this is what I can't understand, and I can't swallow it for the life of me. Where the public thinks that the union people and labor organizations are a bunch of radicals and a bunch of troublemakers. No. There are individuals that have been hurt for so long that they want to get a piece of the pie and they want a nice little piece. They don't want the whole pie, just a piece. And they got management's welfare at heart. Don't let nobody ever tell you no different. They don't have management's welfare at heart. If management had labor's welfare at heart as much as labor has management's welfare at heart, this will be one better country. And there'd be one better steel mills in the whole entire world couldn't compete with us. And they still can't compete with us. See? This is the way the things were running at that time. But thank God they got a labor organization that they don't run this way anymore, see? Because each individual is an individual. And each one has a right to his opinion and his beliefs. And there's nobody going to change it for them.
How did you survive during that 3-year period from 37 to 40 when you weren't called back to
Plymouth? Well, it happened to be, Phil, that I was single, you know, and I was over with my mother and my dad. And it was hard, and we went out and tried to seek work, you know, work with contractors and different things like this, and pick up a few odd jobs here and there, try to keep the wolf away from the door. But that's when, that's the way we did it, and that's all, you know, and we had to either get on welfare or what, but I was able to my mother and my father at that time, say. And my dad was still out on strike, you know. He didn't get back to work until 1939, something like that.
Did the union, was the union able to help any of the families that were affected by that?
Yes, they helped them as much as they could help them, you know, and give them food vouchers and things like that there, you know. They made sure that nobody went real hungry, and if they'd lost, if they were down and out, they would take care of them, you know. So See, but then there was a lot of individuals would go out and get jobs with different contractors and things like that. There, you know. But as far as I know, nobody ever went hungry during the steel strike. You know, I know this for a fact. So.
Were you blacklisted during that period of time? Because it seems like some companies had a list of individuals who were either leaning towards the union or were union organizers.
Well, by me not getting back right away to work, you know, and the only thing that I could figure at that time was that I was one of the individuals that was blacklisted all over, because I tried to get work in other steel plants, and no, they wouldn't hire me. You know, I tried to go to the sheet tube. I tried to go to Republic Steel after the steel strike was over and everybody was back to work, and I wasn't working at Republic. No, they wouldn't hire me. So this is when I figured that they had blackballed me right away, say. So whether it was true or not, I don't know, but this was my opinion that why I couldn't get hired, and they were hiring them all over the place, you know, say.
I realize you weren't in the plant immediately following the 37th strike, but when did the plants, let's back up a step, when did the plants finally get union recognition in Republic Steel?
The year after the steel strike, when it got through negotiating and everything else and all the cases, and then the National Relations Board held an election into the plant, held an election. You had a right to vote whether you wanted a labor organization to represent you or if you wanted somebody else. And the United Steelworkers of America at that time was the CIO, won the election, and the National Relations Board submitted the ruling to the Republic Steel that these individuals, the workers here, want labor, the United Steelworkers of America, the CIO at this time, to represent them as their sole bargaining agent. And this is when the Republic Steel had to agree to it, and all the steel plants of the little steel strike. See.
And that was in 1938?
I think so, somewhere like that, 38 or 39. And the latter part of 37. But they recognized it all right. They did what they had to do according to the law, but they never practiced it.
Do you think one of the, some people have suggested that one of the reasons besides that forced the election was the fact that a lot of the so-called little steel companies wanted, there was a build-up starting for the Second World War, evidently, that really swayed them as far as leaning for unions because they would get orders that were building up in defense and so forth.
I really couldn't tell you to truthfully about that, Phil, because I really don't know what management had in mind and things, you know. So, because whether that was true or not, and they got their heads together, you know, they all got themselves organized good, but they didn't want us to organize. Yeah.
Do you know what happened to the people who served as company unionists after the election? In other words, were they just disbanded and that was the end of it, or?
No, they just done away with their union, company representative union, and they've done away with it. Then all the individuals that were representatives were still on their jobs. They had their jobs, you know.
You mentioned Forrest Cavalier was an attorney.
He was
a young person, I guess.
Yes.
Not new to the profession, but fairly young in his practice. And you mentioned a certain amount of notoriety came out. Was that because of the 37th strike that he handled, because of the cases he handled there, or in other words, what brought Judge Cavalier to the, well, presently Judge Cavalier?
Like I stated, he was an attorney and doing a good job, and then naturally, labor figured that we were obligated to him. Of the job that he'd done so well, and to represent the people that were on strike that had convictions put against them and things like this, and which you represented all right in this area. And naturally, every time Forrest Cavalier decided to run for office, why, he had labor's participation 100%, say, had labor support, and which he appreciated, you know. And no doubt he did. And I still say that he was a fine judge. I don't, there ain't nobody gonna tell me no different, because I had a lot of confidence in the man. And I still have a lot of confidence in him. Too bad he got old, you know, but we all have to do that.
were there other labor attorneys besides Judge Kavanaugh?
Oh, yes, we had Lee Pressman from the International. And under Lee Pressman, his understudy was Arthur Goldsberg. And they were the attorneys that done all the negotiating during the 37 steel strike and all that, and all the negotiations and lawsuit cases with the Supreme Court and everything like this here.
Was Arthur Goldberg, how old was he then? Was he a young man?
He had to be a young man, yeah, not too old.
Okay. Now, was this the same one that President Johnson had?
As a Supreme Court Justice? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, okay. he was a legal staff of the United Steelworkers of America Union at that time.
Was he active in Youngstown? I mean, was he here quite a bit during that particular?
About two or three times, you know. He would get all his information from the other attorneys, you know, and then they would pile it up together and then go from there, see. But he came to Youngstown a few times, yes.
But he did he act as a defense counsel, or was he just helping the union make its case for the NLRB?
No, he was a defense counsel for the union, him and Lee Pressman.
But I mean, was their main idea, like, for instance, was it the Division of Labor, if you want to call it that, like Judge Cavalier would handle the cases, but that they would, like Attorney Goldberg, would handle like NLRB cases, or how was that?
So the only way of things that I can remember is that all the evidence that was gathered against, say, well, let's use myself, okay? So when I got picked up to go to jail, they had charged me with citing a riot, and I just forget what the other charge was. But anyways, naturally, I pleaded innocent of the facts and everything, and Judge Cavalier was the attorney. And he represented me there and got the decision and fought the case, okay? So then I come out, and all the evidence was against me that the company held, or whoever held it, they would in turn give it to Goldberg and Lee Pressman. Say Lee Pressman was the attorney. And he would keep this on file. And he would, when the other trials would come up, he would show the courts that Republic Steel Corporation, we'll say, didn't want to call Fred Fortunato back due to the fact of union activities, see, and due to the fact that he was prosecuted for error, charged with these charges,
see, because of the union
of union activities. So therefore, Republic Steel don't want Fred Fortunato back. All right, and this is the way it went.
See, now these charges was a result of the incident stop five, or that was the previous one where you were
then were charges made against me for the riot that they say the riot at Rosenbaum's store.
Oh, right.
That's the one, say. And during the big riot at stop five, nobody went to jail. Okay.
No, I was just trying to clarify.
Right. It was on a kind of the riot of Rosenbaum store. I wouldn't call it a riot. I would just say a little misunderstanding down there. That's all it was. Because a riot were
you
bust up a lot of things. So.
There are two other questions I wanted to ask you related to the 37th strike. One was, how were just the bands used to supply the company, or as there was a recent article by George Rice about airplanes that were used at several plants. Were airplanes attempted, or were they used at
different plants? Oh, yes, they were used. Sure, there was airplanes used. They were used, they even used the railroads, you know, as far as that goes, as they put stuff in railroad cars, you know, and refrigeration cars and airplanes. Anyway, they could drop them down to them, you know, food and whatever they needed, you know, and stuff. Sure, there was, they tried everything. They tried everything.
But, I mean, did they use the planes at your particular plant? there? Do they try to, do they have any place they could land them, or do they try to supply them?
They could come on down and enter the plant real close, you know, and just drop the stuff right on down. Mm-hmm. We've seen airplanes time and time again flying across there, but whether they dropped anything or not, I don't know. But I do know that they try to use trucks to get into the plant, and it wasn't successful. So then their last resort was to get they come in railroad cars. Because you see, when you're coming into the plant of Republic Steel, the B&O Railroad comes in the Republic Steel plant, and it comes off the main line and goes right on down and comes into the siding of Republic. And this is the way they did. And they could drop it off there. And on the other side of Poland Avenue, over across the river, there's the New York Central system and the Erie system. The sidings are over there. They could drop them off there and bring the food in without having anybody hurting them and stuff like this, because they couldn't get in there, see, because that's company property. We weren't allowed in that property, see, and we wasn't allowed on railroad property, because then we'd be picked up for trespassing, see. So we wasn't allowed there, so the best way we could do was to protect our interest was to stay on this side of the tracks and stop anything from going in there, see. So.
Okay. The planes that they look like there were planes actually landing in, like smaller planes, or they would just look like they were flying over?
These little smaller planes, you know. Well, whether they were flying into the plane or not, but they were flying kind of low, okay? And whether they were dropping anything, I didn't see it. But this is the same thing that you were saying, that you read in that article, and I read the same thing, and I knew that they had airplanes, but whether they dropped them or not, I don't know. But when he come out in the paper with it, he must have all the facts, and this must be real true stuff. See, because they dropped some off and warned.
They didn't identify whether they ever actually landed in Youngstown.
No.
Did you see any planes that looked similar to the ones that they had pictured in the article?
The truth of what you feel, I just couldn't remember, you know.
Finally, if after the events that took place that night, when everything settled down, did you go home that night, or did you go like to the union office down the street, or where did you go after all that took place?
After everything was over, when I stayed there all night long, and I didn't go nowhere. And then on the way going home, I stopped at the union hall, and it was closed, and they opened up and seen what was happening, and we didn't know until we got all everything that was gone. But we do know that the two individuals that were got killed, and all, and I had went on home, and I come back about 5 or 6 hours later, but everything was done and nobody was being harmed. The street was clear and everything else, you know.
When you went to the union hall, there were people there. Do you recall who was down there?
No, I don't know at this time, you know.
And what was the basic activity? Were people just trying to find out what happened, or?
Yes, that's all true. They're trying to find out what happened and who caused it and things like this, sir, you know, and we couldn't give no answer because we knew we didn't cause it. And to be truthful with them, we couldn't say, well, John's done it or this one done it, until we got the facts and found out just exactly what happened. And after we find out what happened, then we would let the people know that they wanted to know it. So.
How were, or maybe it was at random, I'm assuming when they said you were gathering information that they were bringing witnesses, eyewitnesses in, and they were talking to whoever. Were they talking to, like, Mr. White or yourself or other people? And how many people were there, that kind of thing? Like, what was going on there?
Well, there was... The staff man, Uwe Scarsella, would be at the union hall all the time, you know, and there would be some of the other officers there. Tommy White could be there, and naturally people would ask him questions, and he couldn't answer them, and neither could I answer them, you know, until I didn't know what to tell him. I couldn't say, well, hey, this one started or something, you know. Mm-hmm. No. Until we found out the truth and everything else, then we'd let him know. Then when we found out that there was a misunderstanding and things, and this is the way it started, and that was it. And this is what we did.
The
we didn't condemn either side.
Yeah. What I was kind of getting at were like, how were witnesses or whoever, in other words, how did they gather the information? Did they just have some people who were just down on the picket line and they pulled them in, or did they just, people that wandered over that way kind of just gravitate towards the office? Or, in other words, who were the witnesses and how did they arrive at?
The ones that were on the picket line at the time of the incident happened, the women and the men that was there that was actually involved in this thing, these are the ones that testified. These are the ones that gave the information, and this exactly what transpired at the riot on Stop 5 Poland Avenue and how it was started. These are the ones. And the woman that was involved, whether she got slapped or whatever happened, she gave the story. And a few men gave the story.
But and they all agreed on
the story. It was all the same. The same story from this woman to this man to that woman and that man. And they all were the same, that they did not start any problems or have any arguments with the police or nothing. And whatever happened was, there was like a misunderstanding and the cop didn't like it and he shoved her or done something, and that's when all hell broke loose.
Would you feel comfortable, I don't know, you know the lady's name, but you mind telling me who the woman was?
I really don't know, Phil, to tell you the truth. I really don't know, yeah.
But, so, okay, the, about how many, if you want to call them witnesses, were there, I mean, from the picket line, how many people came in, roughly?
About 15.
About 15?
Yeah.
And they were all the people that were on, actually on
all the them on a picket line, right. It was all there.
And what, okay, what story did they tell you about how it actually started and told everybody else, of course?
The information that I got from the people that were telling me, Phil, that they were walking up and down the sidewalk singing songs, okay?
In front of the tunnel?
No,
out
on Poland Avenue.
On Poland Avenue.
See, it wasn't loud in the tunnel because that was public steel property.
Uh-huh.
Out on Poland Avenue, they were walking up and down Poland Avenue singing songs.
Mm-hmm.
It was ladies there at the picket line,
yeah.
Okay? And to get a little morale builder, say, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And walking back and forth and singing songs and everything else. And the police was there. And they were talking. The police and I, they were all talking there.
Yeah.
Okay. So I seen things were running real smooth. So I get in my car and I went home. And a few hours later, then I got...
Could you tell me what the eyewitnesses told either yourself or some of the other union people at the Republic, I believe it was Republic office, the night of the, when they opened fire? Excuse me.
What they told me is that they didn't start anything and everything was peaceful. Whatever happened, hey, it was a misunderstanding, and one of the police shoved the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when it started. And they all said the same thing, see. So naturally, we had to believe one, all 15, if there was any of them that contradicted themselves, 15 or 10 or 15 people, they all come up with the same testimony. So therefore, it must be true, see.
Well, they claimed then how it started was that a policeman had shoved the woman, and then the woman had, because she didn't like being shoved, pushed the policeman, and then what events took place until you got there? In other words, what did they see happening? I mean, how did the violence start, and what, did the union attack the tunnel, or, you know, that kind of thing? What were the events that followed this woman's incident with the policeman?
What was told to me, Phil, when I got back, when I come back there, that somebody had shoved the woman, okay? And she, in turn, and a few of the other individuals defended themselves against the police department. And the police ran, the city police ran in the tunnel of Republic Steel and went into the plant. There was nobody on the street then, see. But they were defending themselves. That was that. From there on in, that's when all the other problems started.
I mean, did they say that after the police withdrew into the plant, that, like, was that when the shooting started, or the tear gas, or you know, what was the...
It started after that, right after that, see. And they were protecting themselves, but they never could get down. They couldn't get down to the tunnel because there was a gate there that was closed, see. But all the police ran into the tunnel, into the Republic Steel for protection. And none of the policemen got hurt. None of them, see. Outside that little shove, whichever occurred, that the woman shoved the policeman and she in turn, and the other ones in turn went after him or something. If there was any punched or something, or buddy got hit, I don't know. But I knew one thing, they all ran into the gate and stayed there.
Now, at that point, did the picket line, okay, first of all, were there other people in the area, you know, that were Union people? Or like, were they, you mentioned, I think, that there was nightly gatherings to inform people about what was happening with the strike and then the Union and so forth. Were there other people either across the street, down the street, or any place else where, when this was going on, when the shoving took place?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of people on Cloven Avenue. Yeah, there was a lot of people on Cloven Avenue on the other side of the street, but all the pickets were on this side of the street, on the Republic Steel side of the street, see. Okay. And it was, naturally, the others were on strike, but they didn't want to get them to make themselves seen, so they would walk up and down Cloven Avenue. But they were all welcome there, and there were no problems there.
Did your union get support from other unions? I mean, were there other people who would appear, let's say, to speak or something in support of your strike?
Yeah, well, they would have people come in from the United Mine Workers, you know, and give you encouragement, you know, not to get disgusted and discouraged that it isn't as bad as a lot of people think it is, but we'll win if you stay together, you know. They would come down and give talks and all, you know.
So, to kind of set the stage, after the woman shoved the policeman, they withdrew, then the picket line moved across the street, or they stayed where they were?
They stayed where they were for a while, and then they moved across the street when the shooting started, and they started going up Powersdale Hill, okay, to get under cover. That's it. And that's when the bus was turned off down sideways and the cruiser car was turned.
Now, when you say a bus, was that a public transport?
City bus, yeah.
City bus. Okay. Did the people say that from the plant that there was, did tear gas come first, or did people just start shooting, or in other words, how long from the time that incident took place to whatever happened next? Did the shooting or the gassing or whatever?
They really didn't know what come out first. Whether the tear gas come out first and the shooting came with it, no. But there was so much commotion that nobody could recall what come out first. But there was tear gas shot. There was shells. There was other shots shot and everything else. Now whether they both were combined or not, nobody knows. Say. And if anybody would say yes, the tear gas came first, would be lying. Or if they kept shooting first, they would. They're lying, but I'm going to say to you that whatever came first, it seemed like both things come at one time. And whether the tear gas first or the shells first, I couldn't say either one.
So the tear gas that you encountered probably was that immediate, well, whether it was gunshot and...
When it first started.
Yeah.
You know.
So you, when you first were pulling in, that's when it first started breaking loose.
Yes.
I didn't know that. After they took the testimony from these people, well, I don't want to make it sound legal, but when they took this information, did the union do anything with it? Did they file it with, like, the NLRB or somebody? In other words, was there a written record first, I guess I should ask you, did somebody take notes or something? And second of all, was that information ever passed on to, let's say, like the National Labor Relations Board or some other organization, the Fall Committee or...
All that information was gathered, and it was submitted into the cases of the Republic Steel, United Steel Workers of America versus Republic Steel, and same thing with the National Relations Board. When you build a case, that you get all the evidence, and this evidence was presented to the both courts, and that's the way that was.
So there is some kind of record of the testimony of the individuals who were on the picket line, or just the union side of it, or the management's or whoever's side, or were the individual, like for instance, if Jane and John Doe said, No, this is what I saw. Did they say this is what Me and John Doe said?
Or? I really couldn't tell you, Phil, whether they still have the records or not. But I mean, this is the only thing I know is they gathered all the information they can gather, built the case, and submitted it to the both courts. And this is what happened, and that they rendered a decision. Now, whether they used each individual one, I don't know. You know.
Yeah, but I mean, at the headquarters, the night that that took place, were people taking down written statements from people, or were they just writing? I mean, in other words, did somebody from the union say, this is what Jane and John Doe said? And
oh, yes, yes.
So there, so there is some place, probably today still, there's a written record of what people had to say after.
Yes, I really couldn't swear to it, yes or no, you know. But they, this is the way they did it. They took and took information of what people says, you know, and what transpired, and all, and they basically, if they were all the same, then they would just let it go at that. So.
Was Mr. Goldberg involved in either the NLRB proceedings or the U.S. Steel, the U.S. Versus Republic Steel case?
All I could say is to be truthful, I mean, I never was at none of the trials, but they were the legal advisors, him and Pressman, were the legal advisors for the labor organization, and actually they, to my opinion, I think that they would be there to represent the union and present the case to the National Relations Board, and plus present the case to the Supreme Court and the Third Circuit Courts of Appeal. So, and they were the legal staff.
Okay. And the 15 or whatever the number was of people that were interviewed that night as eyewitnesses because they were on the picket line. Did you interview any of those people personally, or were you just kind of there physically and then like that information was passed on to you, or what? In other words, what was your role?
I was at the hall when they came in. I didn't interview none of them. I didn't take any testimony down from none of them. There was an individual there that done all this, okay? From the legal staff, who he was, I just can't recall. He took all the testimony down. All I done was I was listening to what some of the conversation and all, and I let it go by themselves, but I was there. And all I can remember was, truthfully, what the individual said that after he had interviewed all these people, that...
Now, this was the legal person
right,
that interviewed all these people.
All the people that he interviewed had the same are almost the same response as the first one did. Says, and the only thing that he could say is that it comes a long, long way before we could be accused of this thing because it's all the other side. So that's the only thing I know.
Well, I'd really like to thank you for taking the time this morning to you know, to tell me this, tell me what took place that night, and I'm sure that other people who are doing research on it will appreciate it also. Thank you very much.
Phil, I appreciate it very much, and this is the story of the 1937 steel strike, to the best of my knowledge, I guess, because it's been such a long time, you know. But it was a pleasure to have you, and if I can be of any more assistance, boy, I might try to help you as much as I could. But I do hope that these tapes will go and be to some value to the students of the school. But in closing, I want to say that gave a good taste and good thinking on the public and everybody that the labor organizations are not what they think they are, that they're a bunch of hoodlums or not. They're first-class citizens, and they're out there to win and gain the benefits for the individual to advance and come to be a good American and a good citizen.
There's one question I'm sorry I missed. Were you called by any of the committees that followed up after the incident at South Point?
Called for what?
You know, to testify.
No, the only time I appeared in the court was at the time of that riot, and all my testimony was there, and they would take it from there, and they presented my case all the way through. I never did appear. Never appeared in any of the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.